COVID-19 vaccines on their way soon. A GOP lawmaker blames Governor Holcomb for her resignation. Plus, Curtis Hill asks for a CARES Act extension and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending December 4th, 2020.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Indiana health officials say they hope to make a COVID-19 vaccine available to every healthcare worker and nursing home resident in the state by the end of December. Drug makers Pfizer and Moderna are currently awaiting federal authorization for their vaccines. Indiana Department of Health Chief Medical Officer Dr. Lindsay Weaver says the state hopes to get initial shipments as early as mid-December.
That first week, our allocation is going to be smaller. But then the next week, our goal, if we get the amount of vaccine that we're hoping to get or that we have projected out through December, we'll go ahead and open it up to all of our healthcare providers across the entire state.
Weaver says the state will have more detailed information next week about vaccine distribution.
A lot about who we're going to start vaccinating will depend on how much vaccine we get, when we'll be getting it, and what is the safety and efficacy for that vaccine.
The state will not mandate anyone get the vaccine. Should the vaccine be mandatory for anyone? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwann is host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, this is great news, but is it really a light at the end of the tunnel if it's not mandatory?
Well, I think what we have to recognize is that this is going to be a gradual process of vaccinating the public. We're prioritizing people based on their risk category. I went on the New York Times, for example, and they've got a calculator on there, and I'm 92nd in line, basically. I'm in the 92nd percentile. So it's going to be a while before a guy like me is getting vaccinated. I think that's important. I think the public's trust in this process has been shaken from being politicized on both sides of the political aisle. I think it's going to take a while for people that may be prone to not trust vaccinations to come around on this. Nobody's really talking about a mandate right now. I think that's pretty heavy-handed to do right out of the gate here, in particular because you can't vaccinate everybody at the same time. We just don't have the capacity in the system to do it. It's going to take a while.
Yeah.
No states are really looking at mandates right now. Employers are weighing whether or not they should mandate. So I think that's a legitimate conversation that's going to just continue to take place. But I don't think it's the right time right now, just because of the newness of the vaccine. Some questions. It's not even approved yet, so there's still questions of efficacy and safety. So I think as we move along here, trust will grow.
Yeah, Ann Delaney, is there a conversation to be had about making it mandatory, but is that much further down the line?
Well, I mean, Michael's right in the sense that it's not going to be available to everybody on day one, but everybody in the category, it seems to me, should be mandated. We require smallpox and polio vaccines to go to school. We require people to wear seatbelts. We require them to wear helmets when they ride on motorcycles. I mean, it is if we're going to eradicate this virus, it seems to me it's got to be by everybody taking. And if it's the two injections or whichever one it is that is determined to have the most efficacy or to be most available, I think everybody has to take it. And, you know, it's not a political statement. It's a safety issue. And it's not just a safety issue for the person who doesn't want to take it. It's a safety issue for all those around him, so or her, whoever it is. So I don't have any problem with mandating it. As soon as your category for Michael, it'll be, you know, after 91% of the population is already inoculated, it may have herd immunity, whatever the heck that is. But I think if we're going to eradicate this, I think everybody's got to take it. And if trust has been broken in this process, it seems to me it's incumbent upon leaders to stand up and say, we're taking it. We think it's effective. For Dr. Fauci to give it an okay, which I'm sure will happen. And everybody ought to be man up, as the expression goes, and take it.
Nikki Kelly, Ann just pointed out that we do mandate vaccines here in Indiana for folks going to school. Is it possible that we will see that maybe a little down the line during the legislative session, that that's added to that list.
Really doubt it. I remember when the HPV vaccine came up and all that they had to do then, and the bill was written in such a wide way. And even the ones that Anne mentioned, we have extremely wide exemptions for people who have faith-based objections, who have medical objections, whose doctor just says, no, I don't think they should have it. So even though we do technically have mandates, they're not all-encompassing. And so I really doubt the supermajorities of the Indiana legislature would go there.
John Schwanes, we've heard from Mike and Anne the idea of trust, whether it's been broken, whether there is trust in this vaccine and this process. And we've seen some polling recently, national level, and let's take polls with a grain of salt, but it suggests that there is some really differing levels of trust based on different groups of people. Is that going to be a problem over the next several months as this vaccine becomes available for everyone who needs it?
Sure. And I would just point out first that I really think Nikki's doing a good job with the herd immunity with the bison behind her. I'm not sure that's how you get it, but anything to get a leg up on this virus. I think it will be a problem. And there's no surprise that there's a split in that kind of public opinion. That's basically the same split probably that we saw very much play out in the presidential contest, where you had people saying that the virus was effectively fake news. And so those individuals who think that, A, the virus is not a real existential problem, or B, worse, you have some people who say that the vaccine is not just sort of ineffective, but actually in some way part of a plot to, you know, remove people's spirituality. I mean, you've seen all kinds of things out there from sort of the fringes. You'll be dealing with that. Health officials will be dealing with that. But I think once it becomes clear that, right-minded people are taking the vaccine and are apparently enjoying the benefits of it without any negative repercussions or consequences, then I think people will come around and say, okay, this is probably a good thing. And in the meantime, even though we won't see a state mandate, I would not at all be surprised to see various employers mandate it, or certain types of schools or certain activities. You know, if you want to take part in some sort of extracurricular activity, if it's not mandated in state statute that every Hoosier get this,
right,
there's certain things that can be done that, you know, if you want to do this voluntarily, this activity or this enjoy
right.
this benefit, right. you must take the vaccine.
Well, just think what would happen if Donald Trump would stand up and say, I'll be first in line to take the vaccine.
Probably not going to happen.
All right. Well,
he's been touting it.
We'll see. Time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we post an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question: should getting the COVID-19 vaccine be mandatory? A, yes, or B, no. Last week, which was actually 2 weeks ago, should the Indiana House and Senate make mask wearing mandatory for members during session? 89% of you said they should, just 11% said no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Republican Christy Stutzman will soon step down from her seat in the Indiana House of Representatives, and she's blaming Governor Eric Holcomb. Stutzman runs a tourism business with her family, the Barnes at Napanee in northeast Indiana. In a Facebook post, the second-term representative says the governor's unilateral COVID-19 restrictions have put the business in serious jeopardy. And Stutzman says Holcomb's latest restrictions forced her to resign to focus more fully on keeping the business afloat. The only new requirement for businesses in Holcomb's latest executive order says they need to post a sign about face coverings and ensure employees and customers are wearing masks. The governor's latest order does more strictly limit social gatherings, including weddings, which Stutzman's business hosts. However, venues like hers can get approval from local health departments to exceed those gathering limits. Holcomb wished Stutzman well and says his decisions have been informed by talking with public health experts, community leaders, and businesses across the state.
I would have welcomed her input and still would, but I can't pretend to understand all the intricacies of that business or the projected blame on any one individual. We're living through a public health emergency.
Stutzman's replacement will be chosen by a private Republican precinct caucus. And Delaney, is this a fair accusation to level at Governor Holcomb?
Good riddance. Let her go. I mean, my criticism of Governor Holcomb is that he didn't do a lockdown fast enough. He still hasn't done a lockdown. It doesn't have to be a complete lockdown, but we need to go back out of stage five. And we've seen that because we're the second highest per capita of hospitalizations in the country, the second highest state in the country. And it's all started when he started lifting those restrictions. So my problem with Governor Holcomb is that he hasn't done enough. I mean, she invested in a tourism business and then a pandemic hit. Okay, and they're asking to wear masks and they're restricting the sizes. So I guess her profits from that tourism business are more important than the lives of Hoosiers, because that's what she's saying. Let people come and assume the risk and get COVID, which we've seen from the large gatherings happens all the time, which is, I mean, look at the Dakotas where they, you know, you have to have a motorcycle rally and then you have to have incidents of COVID infection off the charts. I mean, her position is completely unreasonable. And if she is that unreasonable, it's good riddance.
Mike O'Brien, I imagine that Christy Stutzman is not the only person who feels this way about the governor's decisions the last several months, is she?
Well, I think this is reflective of the part of the state she comes from, which is very conservative and is likely to oppose a mask mandate and think that is an extreme intrusion of government. And I think what you're seeing in the decision by Christy Stutzman and what Ann just said are the balance and the place that Governor Holcomb is trying to land in balancing public, protecting public health and what the public's willing to accept and do and go along with. And it is a wide range from, we don't want to wear a mask or even put a sign on the door of my business that says you have to wear a mask on one end, or on what Dan just said, he didn't shut down fast enough. All right, well, find me the place in between that most people are willing to comply with and will have a reasonable effect on improving public health and protecting the public. That's the decision he has to make, and it's a difficult one that doesn't make everybody happy.
John Schwanes, I'm not going to second guess Representative Stutzman's decision. She knows what she needs to do for her family and her business better than certainly I ever could. But in a way, isn't she sort of giving up the power to influence these decisions? She talked about them being unilateral and the legislature not being involved. She's also giving up the ability to be personally involved in those decisions going forward, though, is she not?
Well, I guess that is a fact. I don't know. Like you, I'm not going to second guess her decision because I don't know what her spreadsheet looks like or her ledger book. And maybe the circumstances are such that she literally has to devote all her time and attention to the business. But you do wonder, given that the measures in place were not nearly as strict as they could have been, certainly not as strict as what Ann has been calling for you know, weeks and weeks. And there were these avenues for her and other business owners in similar realms to try to explore, to get exceptions from local health officials, to make things work perhaps without just, you know, sort of throwing up one's hands and saying, okay, I can't do it. So you wonder if maybe there had been more of an exploration of those options that maybe this could have worked.
Yeah, that's, Nikki, I want to finish on this topic with you on that sort of idea. I think a lot of people looked at this, at Representative Stutzman's post and what she explained and went, really, this last executive order was what pushed it over the edge?
Yeah, I mean, technically, the restrictions have slowly been lifted. There's very little left except for mask wearing and you know, keeping some social distancing. So the idea that suddenly after 8 months of this, she, you know, couldn't, you know, serve. I mean, I really think she probably knew going into that election that this was a possibility. And I think constituents deserve to know that.
Well, Indiana's Curtis Hill and four dozen other attorneys general from around the country want Congress to extend the deadline to use federal COVID-19 relief dollars. The National Association of Attorneys General sent a letter to congressional leaders this week. Congress passed the CARES Act in late March, sending trillions of dollars to the states to help address the COVID-19 pandemic. The states are required to spend the money on expenses directly related to battling the virus, and those expenses must be incurred between March 1st and December 30th of this year. State budget leaders have said for months they've asked for more flexibility in those funds and to extend that deadline. Now, the country's attorneys general are joining that call. Their letter calls the December 30th deadline unreasonable, as they say it's clear the pandemic will continue to challenge communities well into 2021. There's been no indication from Congress for months whether any future COVID relief or changes to existing funds are coming. Nikki Kelly, at what point do state leaders have to stop hoping this extension is coming?
Well, I mean, it's pretty much, if they don't get an extension now, a whole host of that money is going to go back. We've sat on it for so long. I mean, the last check was $700 million. Maybe it's down to $500 million. I don't know. But, I mean, I do think it's a fair discussion, because back in March, I don't think any of us knew that we would still be battling this in December. So a simple extension to maybe, you know, the next fiscal year would be really helpful from Congress. And we're not talking about more money or even the flexibility on what to spend it on, but just letting us keep what we already have and use it to keep fighting the pandemic.
John Schwanes, we've seen some progress theoretically this week out in Washington on potentially trying to find some sort of bipartisan agreement on another relief package. But absent that, do you think we can even count on, at minimum, what Nikki just talked about and what this letter from the AGs talked about, which is just an extension of that deadline? Can we even count on that from Congress at this point?
Not sure you can. Even something as simple as that, even something that is coming from attorneys general on both sides of the aisle, it's so politicized. And the issue is so polarizing that people will probably be wondering, oh, but what really lurks here? Is it just an extension, or is there something more nefarious at work? You know, the devil's advocate could say, why didn't the state find ways to spend at the margins, even if, you know, it's sort of related, quote unquote, because lots of states did. A lot of states exhausted their funds with the assumption, I presume, that nobody would call them on it. And I don't know if anybody will call them on it. So that's one factor. And then the good news, I guess, is I think that eventually we will see relief flowing into states and local governments. And the reason is it has to. I mean, literally a lot of states will cease to function. So I think it's not just a matter of being, you know, a wild-eyed, you know, cockeyed optimist here. It just has to happen or things collapse. So help, I assume, will be coming, or the end will be coming.
I was just going to say, I'm not sure how much we want to assume on this particular front. Mike O'Brien, far from the perfect being the enemy of the good, I think at this point we're at the good is the enemy of the bare minimum. But what do you expect from Congress before the end of the year?
It makes so much sense to give flexibility. I don't understand what the holdup is here. The politics, we're past the election. The politics are out of it. You've got 43 states who have signed on to this letter who are asking for this flexibility, and it's like the most federal government thing ever. They've already spent the money, but they won't let the people who they gave it to spend it. So I don't know what to expect. I expected this months ago when the first time states began to ask for flexibility, including Indiana, and it's just not come yet.
Ann Delaney, now the money wouldn't necessarily have to be spent by the end of December. You have to spend it on expenses from the end of December, so they could spend it. Usually it's something like 90 days afterwards, but how soon do Indiana leaders have to just stop waiting and pull the trigger?
They should have pulled the trigger a long time ago. I mean, we have so many people that are hurting. Unemployment benefits are about to run out. People are going to start getting evicted from their homes. We should have spent the money. They're sitting on it, I assume, hoping that the flexibility then will allow them to put it into the state coffers right away so that they don't have to raise taxes or do anything as ridiculous from the Republican playbook as that. But when you have so many people that are hungry and need homes and don't have jobs, it is criminal that the money isn't being spent. And as John's pointed out, other states have gone ahead. But in Indiana, the default position is always don't act. Don't act. Don't do anything. And that's what they're really good at here.
I think they've been acting, just maybe not in the way you would like. But more Hoosiers voted in the 2020 general election than in any election in state history, crossing the 3 million voter mark for the first time. Secretary of State Connie Lawson notes that presidential elections tend to drive higher turnout, but 65% of registered voters cast a ballot this fall, the best voter turnout since 1992. More than 60% of people who voted in this year's general election cast an absentee ballot, whether in person or by mail. That's by far the most ever, driven largely by the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. 2020 also marks the first time in decades that every Hoosier county reported voter turnout of at least 50%. Mike O'Brien, this is obviously great news, but when it comes to the idea of increasing voter turnout, is the bottom line at this point that more interesting elections simply equal more turnout, and it's as simple as that?
Yeah, I mean, your quality of candidates matter. The degree to which you believe a race is competitive or you think that the outcome of that race matters all bakes into whether or not voters are deciding to show up. And that's why we see voter turnout kind of go up and down over the years. When I was county chairman in Hendricks County, we canceled elections because we didn't have anybody running against any of the people on the ballot. So we just canceled the thing altogether. Had we had it, turnout would have been, or in the years when we had just one or two people run and we had to administer the election, we'd have 15% turnout, 18% turnout. So all that matters. I mean, this was believed broadly, and I think was correct. This was a high stakes election from the top of the ballot to the bottom, and voters reflected that by showing up in record numbers.
The funny part to me was that we had a governor's race that wasn't in the end, and I think a lot of people didn't think even during was all that competitive. An AG's race that certainly seemed more interesting but didn't end up being that competitive. No U.S. Senate race like we've had the last couple of cycles. And still, it would certainly seem to point to the presidential election, this particular one, driving so much turnout. But Anne, is this almost a bad thing for people who want reforms from the legislature for higher turnout?
Oh,
because lawmakers can say, well, look, we just had great turnout.
Yeah, we increased the turnout by 9%. Nationally, the average turnout increased by 20%. 3 million voters voted in Indiana. 2 million voters stayed home, okay? The Republicans in this state have taken voter suppression to a fine art. Mike's right. It does make a difference for competitive races, certainly. Gerrymandering affects that as well. But it doesn't. There was a lot of interest in the presidential race, which drove us up. But just think about it. We're one of 5 states that don't allow automatic voting by mail. 5 states. And we're going to still be, despite the 9% increase in our voter turnout, we're still going to be in the bottom 10 of the states in terms of voter turnout. So those suppression techniques the Republicans have used have worked masterfully here. And we shouldn't be proud of a 9% increase. We should be happy that it's increased. But we shouldn't be pointing to that as the badge of honor when we're in the bottom 10 of the states to turn out.
Nikki Kelly, there was a lot of attention on Indiana voting laws this election because of the pandemic and changes that other states just made. As Anne just pointed out, Indiana was one of only 5 that didn't expand mail-in voting for anyone who wanted it in the middle of the pandemic in the general election. There was a lot of attention, but do you see anything happening in the coming legislative session on that front?
No, probably not, especially since, I mean, you're right. I mean, Republicans can say, look at this. We had more people vote than ever before, and we didn't have to, you know, loosen the laws. They feel like they kept the integrity of the election, and, you know, we didn't have any problems. So I think they'll probably be happy with that.
And John Schwanis, very quickly, are voters going to be okay with that?
Some, let's face it, some don't pay attention anyway, and they don't care. For those who are activists on this issue, who are battling gerrymandering, who are seeking more competitive races, who are putting their efforts into generating greater turnout, sure, that will be problematic. But I don't think we'll see any significant change, in part because even though we were one of the 5 states that didn't allow automatic mail-in voting, people did it precisely what I thought they would do, which is if they're uncomfortable, we're going to, you know, again, come chase me down later, but I'm going to vote in a secure way that I feel comfortable with.
All right. Well, finally, an Iowa congressional race was certified this week in which the winner was decided by just a 6-vote margin. But my favorite example of a close election comes from 1891 in Waynetown, Indiana. The 2 candidates for treasurer, William Sims and Frank Hollowell, ended in a tie. And to break it, they had a 200-yard foot race. 3 yards from the finish line, Sims, in the lead, tripped and fell. Hollowell fell over him and crawled to the finish line to become treasurer. Anne Delaney, is there a better way to decide an election than that?
I think that's a classic. It's great. Crawling over your opponent is kind of a metaphor for some of the races that we've seen this cycle.
It's not often you end up with two lame ducks in the same race.
It's a good thing Donald Trump wasn't asked to do that. He probably wouldn't have made it.
Well, I will say this. If that was how we had decided the governor's race, I think I still would have picked Eric Holcomb to win that one this particular year. All right. Well, that's Indiana. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, please wear a mask, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.